From the nation's capital, for National Public Radio, this is Josh Darsa speaking to you from the Eisenhower Theater of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. In a moment, another program in the continuing series of national town meetings will be getting underway. The topic of this national town meeting, a critique of Congress. The principal speakers will be Congressman John Anderson, Republican of Illinois, and Congressman Bob Eckert, Democrat of Texas. Following the initial presentations, members of the audience will have the opportunity to present questions to the speakers. These national town meetings are aimed at presenting distinguished figures from various fields, discussing with you, our radio audience, and with the audience assembled here at the Kennedy Center, some of the most important topics of the day. And now, the moderator of this national town meeting, Catherine Mackin.
Welcome to the national town meeting. The topic this morning is a critique of Congress. Now, Congress is a subject somewhat like the economy. It's something that everyone has an opinion on, and it's mostly negative. Our guest speakers this morning are Congressman John Anderson of Illinois, one of the Republican leaders of the House of Representatives, and one of those endangered species, a moderate or progressive Republican, as they are called, and Democrat Bob Eckert of Texas, who is certainly distinguished not just in the Congress but in the whole country because he is one of those very few individuals who understands the energy bill, which is just about to pass the Congress. Gentlemen, your presentation, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you very much, Kathy. I can't think of a much more challenging assignment than to try to deliver a two-minute critique of the 11 months that have elapsed of this 94th Congress. I had thought that maybe my genial friend, who's the chairman of the Democratic Caucus, was going to be here, my counterpart, because I serve as chairman of the Republican Conference, and that I might remind him of something that he said on the 21st of March. At least he was quoted in the Chicago Sun-Times as saying, "What was once a myth that the caucus is all-powerful is shaping into reality." I had thought it would take longer. However, it seems to me that with the defeat of the effort to mandate the Democratic members of the House Judiciary Committee to report out an anti-busing amendment, constitutional amendment, a few days ago, that the myth that the Democratic caucus was going to control this Congress has pretty well been dissolved. I don't think this Congress has been all bad. That may sound strange coming from a Republican. They did pass a meaningful tax bill early this year, giving tax reduction to the American people. Finally, they have arrived at what seems to be an 11th-hour compromise on an energy bill. But on the whole, it seems to me that this Congress has been a disappointment in that too often it has postured itself in an attitude of confrontation with the executive. September of this year, we had a symposium on Congress that was sponsored by Time magazine, and Dr. Richard Fennell was one of the participants, and he said that if, as Ralph Nader says, Congress is the broken branch, and he could have added, I suppose, what former Senator Clark once said, he referred to it as the sapless branch, how come we love our congressmen so much? Well, I think it is accurate that while most constituents think the world of their own congressmen, they hold Congress itself as an institution in very low regard. And someone has suggested that maybe the reason for that is that most congressmen run against the Congress in their own districts and are among its greatest critics. But on the whole, it seems to me that the great debate in this Congress has been over whether or not, at a time of inflation and recession, and particularly with the spectacle of New York City, which crisis was hopefully resolved in the vote that took place late last evening on the floor of the House of Representatives, whether we can continue to go on spending as we have in prior years. And many of the vetoes of the President, and there have been 10, as perhaps you know, this year, have been predicated on the assumption that the time has come to cut back on federal spending and thereby aid our economic recovery. This is a battle, of course, that will go on this afternoon on the floor of the House of Representatives when we take up a tax bill, at which time the Republican minority will once again make an effort to couple with that bill a spending ceiling. Whether we succeed or not is very problematical. But I think it does illustrate the difficulties that we've had under this period of divided government, a chief executive of one party, a Congress in overwhelming control, two-thirds plus one on every committee, 290 members to 145 Republicans. And my criticism would be that too often, instead of trying the path of conciliation and cooperation and compromise, this Congress has elected simply, I think, to play partisan politics and to put itself in a hostile attitude of confrontation.
Mr. Eckhart.
Thank you. Well, I think that a critique of Congress must take into account the whole machinery of government, that is, the moving machinery of government, which consists of the two branches. And I think that John really introduced a matter that I want to address a bit when he talked about the divided government. Actually, I think that Congress is always, by its very nature, like a large, cold machine that's really rather hard to start. But essentially, of course, it is a machine that creates policy upon which the government is operated. The presidency, in the ideal sense, is, well, more or less the ignition system and the starter of that machine. And the president today is not only an executive, but he's a sort of super legislator at the beginning of a session of Congress where the same party is in control of both Congress and the presidency. And indeed, even when the situation is as it is today, there are a number of messages by the president which outline a general program for the nation. And ideally, within the spring period and relatively early in the spring, there are also bills which are presented to the committees and acted on these major measures. It doesn't mean, of course, that even when the president is a Democrat and the Congress is Democratic, that the president's bills, those he proposes, that ignition operation that he performs, is ultimately going to be resolved totally in his favor, but at least the action begins at that point. When there is a divided government, and particularly when the naturally more conservative body, the naturally more deliberative body, the Congress, is in the hands of, well, I think I may fairly say, the more progressive or the sort of the party that is ordinarily the party of innovation. And when the presidency is in the hands of the more conservative party, one of the less innovative nature, our government doesn't really work very well. And I think that's one of our major problems. However, I think Congress has done a good job. It's faced some very, very difficult questions. The very schedule for this week and next, as John has intimated, presents two of those extremely important bills, a continuation of a very necessary tax cut in a time of recession, plus certain tax reforms, and a provision by the Rules Committee that I think is excellent machinery to operate on, the permission to deal with certain other proposals that come in as amendments with respect to these bills. And then next week, we will deal with the energy program. Now, I'd like to say just a word about the energy program by means of example. We really haven't operated well in that field, not nearly as well as we could have operated had we had both the presidency and the Congress in the same party. And I do disagree with John on the proposition that Congress has put itself too much in the posture of an opponent. As a matter of fact, we have been faced with 39 vetoes in the 15 months that President Ford has been president. In the period of the last president, President Nixon, we were also faced with $40 billion of impoundments of funds which had been appropriated by Congress. Congress can't just lay back and take it in that way. After all, Congress is the policymaking body of the country. It is the president's duty to faithfully execute the laws. So Congress has tried to gear itself up to act somewhat as a parliamentary body. It's very difficult to do. I think we've done a good job in the energy program. The original position of the president was to remove controls on oil altogether. We have finally come to the point of creating a somewhat of a plateau in oil pricing. We have tried to meet the recession questions of recession by specific bills. We've overridden a number of vetoes. And I think we've put into effect a pretty good manpower program, and we are now putting into effect a good energy program. If that is not vetoed, and I assume it will not be, I think every commitment that was made in the process of the conference committees writing the bill would indicate that it would not be. And I think we're doing a good job this week. I think we are prepared to do a good job on the tax program. So that lays out in brief what I think about our present situation in Congress.
Now it's your turn to question our speakers. There are floor mics in the far right and the left aisles. That's appropriate, I guess, far right and far left. Please give your name and to whom you are addressing the question. And just to give us a chance to get started here, maybe I would address one that I'm curious about myself, to get the opinion of two people who should certainly know. Whatever became of the freshman class of Congress people who were going to do so much this year? Do you think they really were effective, or have they blended pretty much into the system there and just sort of the same as all other freshmen who come to the Congress?
They have both acted as a body and effectively as a body, particularly in the original reform measures with respect to congressional procedure that commenced at the beginning of this year and was done to a certain extent at the end of last year in the Democratic caucus. There has been extensive reform, bringing more people into the action on the various committees by requirement of certain authority given to subcommittee chairmen, certain rights to members to participate, a kind of an easing of the old rigid seniority system, and in this sense they acted as a body, and of course they were a large enough group to command the respect of the Congress. And since then they have also been absorbed within the committees and devoted their attention to those committees. For instance, in Interstate and Foreign Commerce and on the Subcommittee on Power and Energy and Power, they were very effective in formulating the energy bill which ultimately passed the House. They did the kind of groundwork and the kind of garnering votes and getting the word out and getting people there, and actually ably participated in the legislation itself. But they are more as committee members and more as representatives of their districts. Bob Krueger, for instance, took exactly the opposite side I did, and we're both from Texas, but he played a very active role in offering an alternative with respect to oil price control.
Sounds like you're saying they've been pretty much absorbed into the normal procedure in the Congress then.
Well, they have gotten into the action that way, but they still retain an identity.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Anderson?
Well, I perhaps would be a little more critical of the 75 new freshman Democrats than my friend from Texas, Mr. Eckhart. On the whole, I think they're a remarkably young, well-educated, and interested group. They did ride into Washington, I think, on the crest of the wave of great expectations that this was going to be congressional government, that with the collapse of the imperial presidency, we had launched an era in our country's history where Congress would dominate and rule. And I think it's pretty well demonstrated by some of the forays that we've made into both domestic and foreign policy that a committee of 435 cannot really substitute for the executive branch when it comes to governing this country, either domestically or with respect to its foreign policy. I remember reading a critique of Congress some time ago, which went somewhat along these lines, that as the breadth of the interest of Congress increases, that its ability to arrive at a consensus decreases. And to some extent, I think that's been true, that this Congress, composed of almost 20% of its membership new members, has been very prolific in introducing legislation, to be sure. And as Bob has said, I think they've been very active in some instances, in many instances, on the committees that they serve. But there has been an inability, I think, of that freshman group to really demonstrate that they have within their particular group, within their ranks, a cohesiveness. They come from all parts of the country, and they represent more than one element within the political spectrum. And I think I would agree with your interpretation, Kathy, that to some extent I think that they have come to accept the system to some extent and have blurred their identity as simply new members of the freshman class.
Thank you. I believe we have a question over here.
Mrs. Percy Leon from Sarasota, Florida. I have a two-part question to both congressmen. Do you approve of the intensive investigation of our Secret Service agencies, FBI and CIA? And secondly, do you think there has been too much publicity about that and any other activity of the Congress? I know the people have to know, but remember that our enemies are listening and watching as well.
Well, I certainly, for one, do approve of the far-ranging investigations that have been made of both the CIA and the FBI. Speaking of the latter organization, now, I found utterly appalling and repugnant the revelations that came out just a few days ago about the fact that Dr. Martin Luther King had been the object of surveillance and blackmail and even the subject of notes suggesting that he commit suicide. This is so repugnant to our democratic form of government, and with respect to the CIA investigation, the fact that our government was involved in attempts at the premeditated murder of foreign leaders, I think these are such not just incipient but genuine dangers to the continuation of our democratic form of government. That I salute the effort of both of the committees that have been involved, and it seems to me that the unanimous, I think it was unanimous decision, of the Select Committee on Intelligence to make its report public was a wise thing. I think truth, as Senator Church put it, must be the anchor of our democracy. We must prove that, just as in the case of the Watergate, we are strong enough to absorb the truth and then hopefully take the kind of corrective action that will discipline these agencies and make them the servants of the people and accountable to the Congress, rather than rampaging like rogue elephants through the world, committing all kinds of misdeeds that were apparently numberless over the years that these activities were going on. Yes, I don't know. No one has yet pointed out to me any instances where we have compromised the security of this country, where those committees have been irresponsible in the release of information to the point of damaging our national security. I think that's frankly a red herring, and I believe that the American people are entitled to know the truth.
Do we have another question over here?
Yes. My name is Henry Bashkin. I'm a resident of the district, and I would like to address this to both speakers, if I may. One would expect that the Congress would be particularly interested in responding to what the wishes of the electorate at large seem to be, and I wondered if we could have some comment as to the difficulty in getting reasonable handgun control legislation through the Congress.
Well, that's one of these very hot questions. I'm willing to take it. I have always favored what I think is a practical approach to the whole question of gun control, and that is to absolutely, over a period of time, ban the use of handguns by the public and do virtually nothing with respect to rifles and shotguns. It seems to me that rifles and shotguns are quite different from handguns in that they cannot be concealed, in that it takes time to use them with deliberation rather than they're being handy to end an argument that may be a quick and emotional argument in a tavern between two kids, which may be an accident or an immediate violent reaction at home, or maybe a means by which a person's engaged in actual criminality can utilize arms in order to complete robberies and so forth. I think that we ought to meet that problem. I think we've got to with the rising rate of crime. And I would say that I suppose the reason we have not done so is because congressmen have a little tendency to respond to the intense interest and the long memory rather than the general public interest and the relatively short memory. But I think we are coming to the point where we simply have to grapple with the question.
Well, I think you addressed your question to both of us, and I certainly would be more than happy to reply. I agree with Bob that the chief villain in the piece is certainly the handgun. I favor a licensing proposal. I've never quite understood why it was that we accept with perfect equanimity the idea that an automobile is capable of being a dangerous instrumentality if it's placed in the hands of an unlicensed driver, and we have laws providing for the licensing of drivers. It seems to me that a gun similarly ought to be licensed, and if states will not go ahead and pass adequate licensing laws with respect to guns, that then the federal government must step in and exercise a preemptive role. But I would agree that certainly with respect to long guns, so-called, that they are in a different category, and I think our concentration ought to be on an effort to regulate very strictly. I think, for example, that there ought to certainly be a statute that would prohibit people from carrying handguns. Apparently, at least we saw that in the Fromm case, or I guess it was the Sarah Jane Moore case, that there was no law under which she could be prosecuted for carrying a gun in her purse because there were shells in her purse, but they weren't in the gun itself. It seems to me that we could pass a law that would simply make it illegal for anyone to have concealed and to carry in a handbag any kind of a handgun. And I think that Congress should get on with the job of enacting some legislation in this area.
And not to prolong this, but I'd like to just throw in something. The polls show that the people of the country want this kind of legislation, and people here certainly do, and the two of you certainly sound like it, and your leaders in Congress. How come the Congress just doesn't get on with the thing? I mean, what is wrong?
Well, I can give you one good reason. I think it's because the people who respond to the polls are apparently not the same people who write letters to congressmen. It is the people who are totally opposed to any legislation in this area that are simply forever bombarding congressional offices with mail and telephone calls and so on. There is a national organization very well known to all of you that promotes a lot of this type of correspondence and this organized opposition. And I think
would
it's
you
simply,
say what it is?
It's simply a National Rifle Association. They've got a big building right downtown, not far from where we sit. And I think it's simply that there isn't any organized movement to get this kind of legislation enacted to counteract the baneful effects of some of the organized opposition to any gun legislation.
So anybody who wants to see gun legislation is going to have to go out and organize people in the country to offset the gun lobby. That's what you're saying, right?
I think it would be a good first step.
We have a speaker over, or a questioner over here on the left.
Marcia Cass from Laurel, Maryland. I'd like to ask both panelists which elements of the energy program they think will actually become realities.
Mr. Eckert?
Well, I think that the entire energy program is presently embodied in the conference report will become a reality. The bill includes certain energy-saving processes, including a requirement for somewhat detailed reports from industry as to how they have put into effect an energy-saving program. There's no penalty involved there, but the attention to the question of saving energy should be enough, because the reward is internal. Industry, if it saves energy, also saves money. There's also a provision with requiring that automobiles achieve a higher efficiency so as to use less gasoline or get more miles per gallon. That, of course, went into effect also in another bill. This slightly changes it, makes it a little tighter. There are provisions in the bill for authority in the president to put into effect energy-saving programs, but generally with congressional review. And then there is a provision with respect to the price of oil, regulation of the price of oil. Now, it has been argued that this works in the other direction, because if you kept down the price of oil, people use more gasoline and use more oil in other ways. But we are not really rolling back the price to what existed before the Arab embargo. What we are doing is holding a plateau of price at about what it was at the beginning of 1975, around the end of 74 and beginning of 75. And you will recall, or perhaps you don't know the precise figures, but the price of oil all during the 60s was around $3.35. Immediately after the Arab embargo, the price of domestic oil on the market went up enormously. As a matter of fact, the total amount we spent for it in 72 was $11 billion. In 74, we were paying $22 billion. And if things go on the way they are, it would at least treble. Now, what we've done is set an average. I think that both of those measures in the bill will become law, and I think they should become law.
I have some disagreement with my friend from Texas on the pricing provisions of the bill, as he well knows. I will probably come down on the side of accepting the conference report, because I do believe in trying to achieve some compromise in this important area. I've been hearing, however, from a great many independents in the last few days who say that it is the wildcatters, it is the small independent, not the big seven or the seven sisters or the major oil companies that drill two out of three of the exploratory wells in our country every year, and that the $11.28 price, which I believe the bill would provide approximately for new oil, is not going to be an adequate incentive for them to continue to do the wildcatting that brings new oil on stream. I have some fear, therefore, that the present, I think it's 7 or 8% decline in production that we have registered since 1973, that decline may be exacerbated by the pricing provisions of this bill, and I would have preferred to see something different. The administration, I think, has believed that the pricing mechanism ought to be used as a dual weapon, one to encourage conservation and the other to stimulate and to provide an incentive for new production. But regardless of those differences, I think we do have to get on with some kind of an energy program in view of our present overdependence on foreign oil.
This question right over here on the right.
I would like to ask two questions. One's a continuation of this. In my hometown of Allendale, Illinois, there is no longer a doctor. In the Congressman Anderson's district, there are a great many people living in the country driving 30, 40 miles to work. And in the mining country in southern Illinois and western and southwestern Virginia, they drive even farther. Isn't it quite possible that for a good many people, the price of gasoline, like the price of salt, has an elasticity of zero? Now, I'll ask the second question, which is very simple. On the air the other day, I heard a taxpayer's representative make a statement that Congress paid no Social Security tax. And he ended his statement there, leaving the implication that you drew from a pension fund without contributing anything to it. You might be like to correct that, too.
Well, I can certainly correct you on the latter point, because I think the current rate of contribution is 8.5%. Correct me if I'm wrong, Bob, but I think we contribute 8.5% of our gross salary each month into the congressional fund. It isn't like he's probably confusing it with the federal judiciary, which does have a non-contributory pension fund. But congressmen, although they do not pay Social Security tax, they certainly do pay an 8.5% contribution to their retirement. On the question of what should be done about people who have to drive 30 or 40 miles to see a doctor and what the effect of higher energy prices would be on them, the president in his original proposal did, of course, have a proposal for tax credits that would go to people who would be put into that situation. In other words, even though the prices would rise if we resorted to the free market mechanism rather than fixing a ceiling price on oil, there would be a system of rebates that would return to the people that additional, some of the additional monies that they paid out.
The trouble, though, with that procedure is that the oil companies, of course, make the money, and then, in effect, the government would be subsidizing the oil companies by paying back a certain amount of payment for gasoline.
Well, I think then what we should do is to have a good windfall profits tax on the oil companies. I certainly don't believe that they're entitled to exorbitant profits any more than the chemical industry or any other business in this country. And I think that we could remedy that situation best by recapturing those excess profits through a tax.
Well, I would suggest that we set a reasonable price, at least under present circumstances, so that the price of oil doesn't go wild. And second, that we impose a windfall profits tax anyway, because even under the existing bill, the price of old oil will be permitted at $5.25. Much of that oil can be lifted, as, for instance, we know that Elk Hills oil, because the Navy produces it, can be lifted for about a buck. And even if you consider in, and of course you should consider into the figure, the investment and the risk and so forth in drilling, the Federal Power Commission has estimated somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 and something as a reasonable price for old oil with a 15% profit. With respect to new oil, their calculations come out to around $6.50 or $6.75. Well, new oil is going to be selling at $11.28. The reason for that is that, as I think John Anderson intimated, you don't want to cut out any production of the high-cost stuff. But in so doing, we're paying inordinately high rates for some that cost much, much less. So I say we ought to have a windfall profits tax and a price level in control.
Isn't it true that some of the oil companies wanted the windfall profits tax so that they wouldn't look like people in black hats when their profits went way up?
But what they wanted is an absolute free market price, as they call it. Of course, there isn't any free market price. It's an OPEC price. It's a monopoly price. And then they wanted to say, okay, we above, say, $7.50 will pay 90% of that above $7.50 in a windfall profits tax, provided you will permit us to plow this whole amount back into new production. Well, heck, Southwest, the Bell telephone system has plowed back its profits into additional plant for somewhere around 85 years. The result is, of course, that they've become stronger and bigger and more powerful and have excluded their competition. Of course they're willing to pay a windfall profits tax if they get it all back.
Here's a written question from the audience addressed to Mr. Anderson. It says, in light of the President's original commitment to cooperate with the Congress when he took office, don't you think that he has set out a policy of confrontation? He has often spoken out violently against Congress and thus encouraged the climate of adversary politics.
Oh, I don't think that I would say that the White House was entirely guiltless in this atmosphere of confrontation that we're in. But on the other hand, I would take some exception to the characterization of the President's remarks about Congress as violent in nature. I think as a former member of that body, he spent a quarter of a century there. He has a genuine affection for it, both as an institution and for its individual members. On this question of vetoes, because that's one that's raised commonly, that he's vetoed so many bills, I went back into history, and I found out that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, even with an overwhelming Democratic majority, during the years that he was in the White House, averaged 73 vetoes a year. Another Democratic president, Grover Cleveland, averaged 53 a year, and Harry Truman, who didn't always get along with Congress either, averaged about 33 vetoes a year. So ever since the time of Andrew Jackson and his veto of the National Bank Bill, I think it's been recognized that as a part of the constitutional process, as a part of the right that the president has, and the veto is in the Constitution, as a part of his effort to impress his views on the country and on Congress as to what public policy should be, he has a right to veto. Furthermore, I think there's been a fairly consistent pattern, as I endeavored to point out in my opening remarks, a fairly consistent pattern to most of the vetoes. They have reflected the president's fear that the economy simply would not withstand the kind of overspending that was represented in many of these vetoed bills. Now, ultimately, in November of next year, the country will decide, of course, whether the president's fears in that regard were justified and should be recognized by an affirmative vote, or whether the Congress was right in those instances, three or four this year, where they have overridden the president's veto. But I think that, in general, the president has certainly not gone out of his way to provoke the Congress. On the other hand, to be consistent with his own fiscal philosophy, he had to do what he did with respect to vetoing many of the bills that came to his desk.
I don't see this basis existent in some of the vetoes, like the veto of the strip mining bill.
Well, let me say in that connection that one of the reasons that the president gave in his veto message, as I recall it, was that he felt that that bill, if enacted, would cost 36,000 jobs. Now, you can disagree with that assessment. Another figure that he gave in his veto message was that we would lose between 42 and 176 million tons of coal in production. And because of the energy crisis, because of our need to maximize our own domestic resources of energy, he felt that the bill was simply not drawn in the proper form. So you can argue with those conclusions, and I know you did at the time, Bob, and as a matter of fact, let's be very candid. I voted to override that veto, but I'm suggesting that, you know, the president has not acted in an unreasoning manner. He has, I think, been guided by good instincts and by his own judgment of what the economic situation in this country required and would stand.
Well, let me say this about the veto question. Of course, the president has the constitutional authority to veto, and he should exercise that constitutional authority just as other presidents have done. I suppose that my real difference is not with his not acting within acceptable constitutional limits, but the way he does act and what he does veto. For instance, John Anderson has mentioned the question of jobs in the case of the strip mining bill. Well, we passed a bill to afford jobs, which appropriated $5.3 billion for that purpose. He vetoed it. We finally came back with a $2.9 billion bill and got it accepted. But it seems to me that there's an inordinate tendency on the part of the president to veto the bills that have to do with social benefits and to leave intact the bills that have to do with large expenditures to government contractors. Most of the vetoes have been in the human areas and the place where the budget seems to be somewhat sacrosanct is in areas like national defense and so forth.
Well, let me point out in that regard that there's one reason probably why many of the vetoes have been in what you characterize as the human resource area. It's probably because before 1965, before the advent of the so-called Great Society, income transfer programs. Programs in the human resource area amounted to about $25 billion. This year, they will run something like $141 billion. And we saw just in our morning newspaper today a statement by the Congressional Budget Office to the effect that if Congress continues to expand programs at the same rate for the next 20 years that they did between 1955 and 1975, $1.2 trillion, or more than one-third of what will then be our total gross national product, will be going into these programs. And it's the taxpayers, the middle-income taxpayers of this country, who are going to bear that load. Now, on the jobs bill, the president's veto was predicated simply on the theory that it was $3.3 billion over his budget request. It was predicated on the theory that at least half of the spending would not even occur until the last half of fiscal 76, and that much of the spending would go on in calendar 1977, at a time when it was felt that the natural forces of recovery in this country did not necessitate 900,000 public service jobs. What happened? Less than a month later, as Bob has already said, Congress turned around and passed a bill providing for, I think it was 310,000 public service jobs and about 840,000 a summertime job for students. Congress and the president got together, but only after, it seems to me, the Democratic Congress had provoked him into a veto with a huge $5.3 billion bill that was a real budget buster. And the impact that it could have had on the economy, inflation-wise, was such that I think the president was totally warranted in asking the Congress to prune that bill back to reasonable proportions.
Well, I think, John, you and I both favored the bill creating a congressional budgetary authority and, of course, also curbed impoundments at the same time. I don't think anybody wants unplanned, wild, continually increased spending. As a matter of fact, the House Budget Committee has also been careful in attempting to keep the budget within control. I have here the budget authority of the House versus the administration, and I think it gives a kind of an indication of emphasis. The OMB has $107.2 billion on national defense, the House 99.6. On commerce and transportation, OMB 12.1, House much higher, 17.3. Community and regional development, OMB 5.5, the House about twice that at 10.6. Income security, about the same. As a matter of fact, OMB is a little higher by a couple of billion. Health, the House is a little more by a couple of billion. But the thing is, there's not all that great difference with respect to the question of frugality or staying within the budget. The final figures are, for OMB, $391.8 billion, and for the House, $400.5 billion. So we're not really arguing on the basis of frugality versus waste. We all recognize that waste should be cut out, that there has to be living within a budget, but we have a little difference in direction with respect to where the money is to be spent.
Well, in your figure, just to pick up on that, it's an interesting discussion. The difference, the biggest difference there was on defense spending, as between the House and the administration. Where do you two gentlemen stand on that? Is too much being spent on, was the president recommending too much on defense? Is what the Congress is passing what is needed? Where do you stand?
Well, as I recall it, we finally cut about $6, maybe $7 billion from the original January budget request. And there is a great deal of difference of opinion. Secretary, or former Secretary Schlesinger, of course, is promoting the idea now that we're not spending enough on defense, and that with the surge in expenditures on the part of the Soviet Union for strategic weapons systems, that unless we conclude a SALT II agreement very soon, that we're going to be completely outclassed. That's a very difficult debate. It's not all black and it's not all white. I supported the cuts in spending. I voted against, for example, the long lead time items this year for the B-1, thinking that that program, which ultimately could cost at least $80 billion and maybe as much as $100 billion if we were to build the total complement of planes called for, was the kind of thing that was simply too expensive, too costly. On the other hand, you can read figures, and I've seen them, that as a total percentage of our gross national product, our defense budget is way down to what it was before the war in Korea, and that more particularly with respect to strategic systems, strategic weapon systems, that there has been a decline of something like 34%, I believe, in the last 10 or 15 years in what we are spending as a proportion of our total defense budget for strategic weapon systems. The volunteer army, it has gotten terribly expensive. Again, I certainly supported the abolition of the draft. I'm sure you did, Bob, and the creation of a volunteer army. But something like 60% of our cost today for the Defense Department go to personnel to support the some 2 million men that is our current force level. Maybe we can prune back in the area of civilian employees. Maybe, as was suggested recently, we'll close a lot of bases. Mr. Clements, I think, is trying to frighten congressmen now by suggesting that he's going to close bases around the country. Fine, if we don't need them, if they're surplus to our needs, I think we ought to close them. But all of the cuts can't come out of the defense budget. That's the only point, I guess, that I want to make, Kathy, that some reductions were made by the Congress, and I think we're probably fully justified. But to assume that we can absorb all of the additional costs of new programs by balancing them off with a reduction in defense, I don't think is a realistic view in view of the world situation today. It's still a pretty dangerous place.
Well, I can't say that I disagree with anything you've said about that, John. Of course you can't cut it all in defense. And, of course, on this point, I think we might admit that this is not really a partisan argument because there's been fault on the part of a number of presidents with respect to the expenditures on defense. Frankly, when we were talking about a weapons gap back then, the Kennedy race, there was a weapons gap, but it was on the other side. We were much ahead of the Soviet Union at that time, and when we began to beef up our strategic arms, they began to beef up theirs. The total result was that they darn near caught us. They probably haven't. We don't know. But it isn't that important that you have exact parity in strategic weapons. If you can destroy your enemy twice over, it doesn't do you much good to be able to destroy your enemy seven times over. And that's approximately what both sides have been attempting to do with respect to strategic arms. We also have this difficulty, and I think it's again, I'm not speaking partisanly. We've always had a tendency, when we have a committee devoted to a specific, powerful area of government in which those who sell to the agency of government are attracted to control the committee, we have a little housekeeping function, a little of a clientele relationship between the committee and the contractors and the agency. And I don't think we've had very sharp examination generally by the Armed Services Committee with respect to whether or not that money is spent efficiently.
Question over here on the left.
Carlos Van Leer, to ask both congressmen your comment on this warning from President Kingman Brewster of Yale. Any politician standing for re-election every 2 years has an inevitable bias in favor of spending. He calls this, quote, the disease of public spending, motivated by the desire to be elected, and the greatest threat, in quotes, to the survival of our democratic political economy. My question is, in view of inflation battering our cities, our universities, and endangering the future of our children, what thoughtful response can we take back to President Kingman Brewster in response to his warning?
Well, I had noted that particular statement by President Brewster of Yale when it appeared several days ago. And I think that given our political system, a representative democracy, where people like Mr. Eckhart and I stand for election every 2 years, there is a great deal of truth in what Mr. Brewster says, that there is an inflationary bias in our system of government. It reminds you of the old story that Alvin Barkley used to love to tell about the politician who went around for re-election and came to one of the people that he thought was on his side, one of his old friends, but he seemed to be a little bit disgruntled, and he went through a long list of what he had done for the family, how he had gotten Aunt Minnie's Social Security check straightened out, and how Uncle Fred's veterans benefits had been increased because he had interceded and so on. And he said, well, tell me, if I've done all of this for you, what's wrong? And his constituent said, well, what have you done for me lately? Sometimes there's a tendency, I think, for constituents to look at us in that light. I think it is going to take, the only answer I can give you, sir, is that it's going to take some real political courage on the part of the Congress to resist the blandishments of the pressure groups that have grown up over the years. You know, we have all kinds of lobbies, and I don't mean to imply that they're necessarily evil. But we have the education lobby. We have the lobby that is interested in pushing various health services programs. And they're all there for a piece of the action. Right now, we've got the revenue sharing program up for review, and you've got a mayor's lobby and a governor's conference lobby for that program. And with all of these disparate demands that are being impressed on us daily, it does take a great deal of political courage sometimes to say, well, we'd love to help you. This is a good and acceptable program, but this is not the time. We have to defer the instinct for instant gratification. I think that's a phrase that Daniel Bell has used, you know, that we seem to have lost the ability that our forefathers had to appreciate the fact that maybe we're going to have to wait a year or 2 years or even 3 years for something to happen or to be done. And I think Bob has pointed out that we've got a new budget system that's going to help some. I think it's a more orderly process than we've developed before now. But what it all boils down to, I guess, is that it's going to take a lot of courage on the part of individual members of Congress to say no when no may be very damaging in a political sense.
Well, let me tell you the message I'd send Kingman Brewster. I'd say, Dr. Brewster, you're partly right and you're partly wrong. You know politicians, but you don't know people. Actually, it is true that politicians have a tendency to do the easy thing and frequently simply an additional expenditure is an easy, popular thing to do, or to keep expenditures going that are not practical, as, for instance, the keeping of some air base close to my district like Ellington Field, and I was urged to get out there and try to save Ellington Field, and frankly, I didn't do anything. And I'm not going to say that close to Harris County, but I think, though, that people don't want us to increase spending in areas that are really impractical, that don't bring back any return. I don't think that they want us to decrease spending. I think they want us to spend more efficiently. And I think that people are much wiser than Kingman Brewster believes in his ivory tower in Yale. I think that that actually we are spending a whole lot more money unnecessarily in the private sector than we are in the public. I think we spend more money developing a razor blade that you can screw in by a real device instead of just slipping one in that works just as well, and making all sorts of gadgetry that opens cans by electricity when you can simply turn a handle and do it just as well. I think there's a lot of waste in the private sector and in advertising to sell people things they don't need. On the whole, I don't think there is an inordinate amount of money spent in the public sector. I'd like to see railroads go more straightly to where they're directed instead of twisting all over the country. I would like to see a public transportation system. I'd like to see a much more efficient health delivery system than that we have at the present time. This is not going to be less spending. It's in fact going to be more spending, but we must get rid of some of the public spending gadgetry, just like I think industry and the industrial sector should get rid of some of their private spending gadgetry.
There's one footnote that I might add, Kathy, that Mr. Van Leer might find reassuring. I noted someone sent me the other day a recent Harris poll that commented on the fact that 6% of the world's population, which we are, consume 40% of the energy, and what people thought about that. And 67%, if I remember correctly, of the people did say that they felt that we were going to have to scale down some of our demands. In other words, that we were going to have to change our lifestyle and adjust to something a little bit less than what we had been enjoying in this overly affluent society of ours. I think that shows a kind of realism on the part of the American people that I find very reassuring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly true. I sometimes think that those of us in the media, and probably especially television, could contribute to the understanding of all these problems, especially to the economics involved of how if you spend in one sector, you don't have the money in the other, or where there's wasteful spending. And I don't think that we do a very good job of trying to explain to people in our very shortened stories that we do. Yeah. Is there a question over here?
I'm Kevin O'Connor from White Plains, New York. My question regards New York City. In light of President Ford's support for New York Aid, why do you feel last night's vote on the House floor was so close? And do you think there was a fear on the part of members to vote for New York, realizing they would have to face constituents with an attitude of letting New York bail themselves out?
Oh, yeah. I think surely that was the attitude of a lot of members. I went down to Houston, and I heard the mayor of Houston, who was also a candidate for re-election and incidentally was elected yesterday by about 56% of the vote, just take out after New York. And of course the thing is that New York has got enemies on both sides. The conservatives say, look, this is a great example of expending for social programs to the point where you go into bankruptcy. So to heck with New York. And the more or less populist liberal viewpoint is New York is the center of all this great money power. And if we give money, it's just going to pay the banks back. So you get people attacking on both sides. The real truth of the matter is that New York is in exactly the same position, but to a certain extent exacerbated by its size and its attraction to people from all over the country that other cities are in. What has happened is that we've had a great exodus of a great number of poor from rural areas into the cities. And at the same time, we've had a great number of persons who formerly lived in the cities and supported a strong tax base moving into the suburbs and escaping city taxation. Now, these are problems that are going to hit a number of our cities. We've got to accept some of the responsibility for that problem because we have not always created a proper equalization of tax resources. We can't do that. We can't do a perfect job from the national level, but we certainly could encourage it and improve it. Some instances we've exacerbated it by matching grants so that those who can pay the most money get the most federal money. I think we've got to look into this whole question of tax base and services on a regional basis.
I think one reason, additional reason that I would give as to why so many members voted against the loan was that many members had simply locked themselves into a very inflexible position on the basis of the situation as it existed many months ago. And in the meantime, New York City and New York State had done some very significant things. They had raised
personal income taxes, city income taxes, by 20 to 25%. They had agreed to present a balanced budget by June 30th of 1978. The state of New York had taken some very, very strict corrective action, literally taken receivership of the city through an emergency financial control board. All of those things convinced me to vote for the loan on the grounds that the state and the city really meant business about putting their own fiscal house in order. But I think a lot of members had probably just come out no against this thing at the very beginning and simply felt that they couldn't reverse their position, although I think the change in circumstances was sufficient so that it would have warranted anyone who was initially opposed to simply a bailout, it would have warranted taking a different position on the issue.
I think we have to stop. Both congressmen have to get back to the Hill because they're going to vote on a tax cut for us, and we wouldn't want them to miss that. I want to thank you for joining us this morning. Next week's National Town Meeting will be in the Eisenhower Theater, Wednesday morning at 10:30. The topic, Investigating the CIA, featuring William Colby and Representative Otis Pike, with Walter Pincus as moderator.
Thus, the conclusion of this National Town Meeting, the topic of which was a critique of Congress. The principal speakers were Congressman John Anderson, Republican of Illinois, and Congressman Bob Eckert, Democrat of Texas. The moderator was Catherine Mackin. From the Eisenhower Theater, the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, this is Josh Darcy speaking. Technical director for this broadcast has been John Cater. Funds for this broadcast have been provided by the Mobil Oil Corporation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.